I feel I never had. The years I feel were ripped away from me. Would I still feel so overwhelmed with sadness if I hadn't been taken off a ship in Germany at the age of 18 and spent 4 years in bed and had half my body chopped away? Is it simply self-pity tearing my heart in shreds over an ice cream cone I didn't get when I was a kid? Is it the agony of my wife leaving me that makes it so easy for me to forget the joy of walking down the street hand in hand with Billy? How can I so easily forget the laughter in his eyes and the love in his heart? Oh, dear God, dear sweet God, please don't let me shroud my son's future with the loneliness of my past. Oh, yeah. All right. We continue with relationships, yeah. I don't think this needs any explanation. This night, the topic was blues. Am I blue? Am I blue? Ain't these tears in my eyes telling you? Blues. What's blue? A color? Cobalt? Azure? Blue is the greatest color in the world. Blue is royal. It's more than blue blood. It's aristocracy. Noun. The color of the clear sky. Verb. Transitive. Bluing. To treat with bluing. I remember my mother used to put bluing in the rinse water when she washed whites. Couldn't see how putting blue in the water helped make them white. Later, I remember helping a painter mix white paint, and he put a touch of Prussian blue in it to make it look whiter. So what's blue? Adjective. Livid, as the skin from bruising or cold. The sky. The sea. Ever see the blue of the Mediterranean or the Aegean? Beautiful. So dark and rich and clear, you can see 3 or 4 fathoms. At least so it appeared a few years ago. And the sky that dipped to the Mediterranean was even bluer than the sea. And the air so clear and crisp you could rub it between your fingertips. Oh God, blue sky. Blue water, air sharp and alive. It was exquisite. Now you know everything about Italian Renaissance painting. It's all in the blue. Mary's color. And red, but everyone knows they just stuck the red in there as a backdrop for the blue. Hail Mary, full of blues, blessed art thou amongst. She knew the blues. You better believe she did. The Pieta is white marble, but it's the blues. I mean the blues. You know, man, the blues be more than Billie Holiday or Bessie Smith or anything. You think the blues is a color? Blue moon, you saw me standing alone without a dream in my heart, without a love. Shit. You think the blues be sadness 'cause your old lady split? Man, the blues be in your blood in every motherfucking cell. The blues be in your soul, brother. You don't get up and walk away from the blues. Sadness? That's wimp bullshit. Ooh, poor me, I'm all alone. Ain't nobody loving this poor ass. Shit. Sadness is only skin deep, man, but the blues is to the bone. I'll tell you something you don't know about the blues. They can be chewing your ass up and you can be smiling and scratching and laughing. The blues ain't no bullshit and sadness. Fuck. You think I ain't had my woman cut me loose? I ain't talking no girlfriend, baby. I'm talking about my woman. and she be all up inside me so I can't see straight. I can't look nowhere I don't be seeing her or something remind me of her. You know, man, like you look at a can of Diet Coke and your gut just gets all full of nuts. And ain't no woman nowhere look half so good. I see some natural-born fox strutting her thing down the street, and I laugh. I mean, I fall down, scratching my skinny ass laughing, because she ain't nothing compared to my woman. I mean, she was fine, brother. Real fine. She had these soft, round hips and her neck. Oh, God, she be so sweet. When she left, I had the blues. I sat in my pad and couldn't even think of playing Billy or Bessie. Shit, I listened to the blues, then it make me laugh. It be quiet, my pad, man, stone still. Grave stone still. Sad you listen to Billy sing. The blues, you sit quiet and watch your hands. Yeah, I wonder who she's with and what they're doing. Shit, I know what they're doing. And I can hear that bitch laughing. Can you believe that? She be laughing, having herself a good time, and I'm sitting in this motherfucking chair so goddamn blue I can't think to breathe. But shit, I survive. No fucking way that get me. Yeah, baby, you can laugh with the blues, but sometimes you can't get your ass up to move. Blues, depressed or depressing, melancholy. When you be so sad you can't eat, when something in your gut twists and knots and wrenches and reaches up to your throat and shoves the food out of your mouth, and you feel like you're drowning in a pool of tears, and from time to time a tear oozes itself down your cheek, and you think if it gets any worse you'll just stop breathing, that it can't get any worse without it squeezing the life out of you. Well, baby, when it gets a million times worse than that, you got the blues. Shit. You feel so bad you can't even think of killing yourself. And you live the blues, brother. Sadness comes and goes, and sometimes you go with it. But the blues be there all the time. You don't ever get away. So you got to learn to live with them. You think they sing the blues because they're sad? Shit. They be singing the blues because ain't nothing going to whip them. It's a celebration, brother. I don't cry the blues. I sing the motherfucker. Ain't no sadness, no nothing else going to do me in while I be singing the blues. I sing them loud and clear, baby. But sometimes I just get sad thinking about that woman and how she feel under my fingertips, how she move across the room like she be in love with the air, how she stand with her hands in her coat pockets, and how she flip her hair over her shoulder, her eyes sparkling and dancing, and damn, if it ain't like Christmas, and I hear bells and kids laughing and all that corny shit, and I would feel some kind of good all over. I mean, all over. And I sit looking at my hands, studying my fingertips and nails, not looking 'cause she ain't there, but 'cause I might see her anyway. And man, there ain't no bells, no music, no laughing. And my blue. And my blue. Oh, baby, why'd you have to leave me? Ain't these tears in my damn. More relationships. This This was written for the reading and nothing to do with the book. It was sort of like a joke. However, I think you'll see that it's not humorous. It's called In the Heat of the Night. You know the line from the old song. And too many moonlight kisses start to cool in the warmth of the sun. Yeah, that's what it is. They cool in the warmth of the sun. That's why I had to do it in the heat of the night. I didn't want to, but I knew I had to. I guess we all have those times when we have to do something we really don't want to do, something that goes completely against our grain. Yet we do it simply because we must and cannot escape or avoid that simple fact, as if some power far greater than ourselves is forcing us to do it. It seems to me my relationship with B was the best one I ever had. We met at a friend's house and somehow started talking and got together the next day, and that's how it went. It was all very quiet and simple, yet so totally satisfying and exciting. So different than all my previous relationships. Most of the others started with a real flurry of activity, shows, clubs, weekends on the island or skiing, wining, dining, endless weekends in bed, you know what I mean. There were one or two that weren't explosive from the beginning, but it was a short wait. And sooner or later, they all ended up the same. There were a few that lasted for 6 months or so, but eventually there was the inevitable phone call where she just wasn't feeling well, or a friend just got into town and she had to cancel the date for that night. Perhaps there would be another date after that, but only one at the most, and then the phone call where she says, "I think it's not working anymore, and we should stop seeing each other. It just isn't going anywhere." Just before the phone rings, you know who it is on the other end. You know what she's going to say, and you also know she's right. But still you resist and try to convince her she's wrong. Do everything you can to have her agree to give it another week or so. But you know it's useless, that she's made up her mind and you agree, yet you're powerless to stop your arguments. They seem to have a life of their own and must go on until they die their own death. And even as you're trying to convince yourself that the argument is really a discussion, you know you don't really want to continue the relationship, that you're relieved it's over, that it was not only becoming boring, but a burden. But what it is you're trying to avoid is the anger and bitterness that always follows a busted romance. You know it's her fault it didn't work, but she's blind to that simple fact. No matter how many different ways you prove it's her fault, she can't see it. Just can't see that if she hadn't been so damn selfish, if she didn't always have to have her own way, if she just could have compromised a little. And then, of course, she tries to get off the hook by accusing you of these things. And you end up so pissed off, you slam down the phone and fume for a while. And finally calm down and wait for her to call. And when she doesn't, you call her to give her a chance to apologize. But all you get is her answering machine, and no matter how many times you call, all you get is her goddamn machine. And finally, you're forced to go by her place to see if her light is on, then listen outside her door to see if she's alone, and all you can do is hate the bitch and hope she sees you with your new girlfriend, who is a hell of a lot smarter and a hell of a lot prettier. And then a few months later, it starts all over again. You know what I mean. But it was different with B. We had some wonderful times together, and I have never been with a woman who was more exciting in bed than B. I've never enjoyed washing a woman's hair as much as I've enjoyed washing hers. She had a way of leaning into my hands and smiling as I rubbed her head, then rinsed her hair until it squeaked, and she always giggled the sweetest giggle. God, I can still feel her hair and smell the shampoo and water as it splashed and trickled. But I think the greatest times were the times walking through Greenwich Village, especially on those balmy summer evenings. We would just roam around, up and down and around, always, of course, making sure we walked up Bleecker Street, stopping outside the Italian grocery stores with the cheeses and salamis hanging from the ceiling, and just breathe in that aroma deeply and look at each other and laugh. God, I have such wonderful memories of B. You see, that's the thing I realized. You have this great relationship, have all this fun, and then go through the fights and arguments and end up hating each other. And all you remember is what a rotten bitch she is. You never remember the good times. I just didn't want that to happen with B. It was too beautiful to trash like that. She was too beautiful. So that's why I had to kill her in the heat of the night, when everything was so perfect. Sooner or later, she would have been gone anyway. And at least this way, I have all those wonderful memories for the first time. For the very first time. I wonder if maybe I could build up a whole string of happy memories. I also wonder if she can feel the warmth of the sun on her face. I don't know how long you guys want to stay here. Seriously, because, you know, I enjoy this. I enjoy it very much. I could read all night. So how long do you want to, stay? Like another 5 minutes, 10 minutes? What do you want to do? I mean, you don't have sore buns yet? Huh? Oh, all right, cool. Cool, all right, great. I don't want to run it into the hole and make you feel, all right, groovy. All right, we get back to relationships for a change. This is from the book. And again, this is my relationship with time and dear old dad. And it's called Tomorrow. It was the topic that night. You see, it's not that tomorrow never comes. The problem is it does. And it never does what I thought it would. That's the kick in the ass. It never makes it better. When I was a kid, I thought having 35 cents would do it. And then I got 35 cents. Guess I was about 8 years old. I remember so clearly standing in front of the candy store jiggling that money in my pocket. I stood and jiggled for hours and nothing changed. The world just went on like it always had and always would. Don't know what I expected, but I sure as hell expected something. Like maybe one of the big guys, one of the 16-year-olds, would ask me how much money I had, and I could tell him 35 cents. Or maybe I'd grow a couple of inches, something, but nothing happened. Nothing changed, nada. Always lots of tomorrows and other places. Like being 18 and old enough to drink legally. That's a big tomorrow. Then you can go from one bar to the next because that's where the action is. The next party, that's where it will all be happening. That's where she'll be. Yeah, she, it, are always just around the corner, always in the future. That's something that will change my life. And I believed it. I fucking believed it. Actually, I started going to bars very young. My mother sent me to get my father. Sometimes I liked going because I'd get a drink. But I remember being embarrassed trying to get him up three flights of stairs when he was staggering and noisy. Three flights of stairs, eight steps in one direction, then eight in the opposite. An endless fucking job with him bouncing off the walls and railing. When I was in my early 20s, we were supers in a 22-unit building, and I was in the basement with him one day. He just finished wheeling a supply of coal to the boiler room. He was stoned. could barely stand, and he put an arm around my shoulder and waved his hand in a big arc. Everything I have is yours. Jesus, thanks loads. What a fucking legacy. Schlepping tons of coal from one end of the cellar to the other, then tossing it in the goddamn furnace. You're all fucking hard, Pop. Not until much later, just before his death, did he ever tell me he loved me. I guess that day in the basement was the closest he came to it until then. I remember the darkness and the smell of the basement that day, and the smell of the booze on his breath and seeping through his pores. I smiled and said, I know. I guess I was acknowledging the words that could not come. I remember his hand on my shoulder, his arm around my neck. I've told that anecdote many times, and always with a chuckle, never with the simple acknowledgement that it meant so much to me, that I wanted him to keep his arm and hand there forever. I could never acknowledge to him or anyone else how much that moment meant to me. A huge, dimly lit gray basement, cool cement, a hot furnace, and a stumbling attempt at communication. He could not say what was in his heart, nor did I. There was always a tomorrow that would take care of it. And the story is always told with a chuckle. He was a staggering, falling down drunk, but his hand and arm were light and warm and friendly. Friendly and comforting. When I was 13, I had appendicitis, and my father carried me down those 3 flights of stairs to the cab that took us to the hospital. And I remember how I was suddenly overwhelmed with the fact that he loved me. I was a big kid, taller than him by this time, and he carried me down those stairs, holding me tight, rushing as fast as safety would allow, and I have no memory of pain at that time. My head was hanging over his shoulder, and I was vaguely aware of the steps rapidly going away, of the sudden turn on each landing, and in my memory it was silent. Not only no words, but no sound from his feet. I had been doubled over with severe pain for hours, and it was gone for those moments on the stairs. My arms were wrapped around his neck, and I was overwhelmed with the intensity of his love. He loves me. My father loves me. It was happening right then, not tomorrow. Yet I spent a lifetime waiting for him to say it, waiting for the tomorrow when I would hear the words, just words. Tomorrow. Everything was going to happen tomorrow. Some fucking tomorrow. My father would tell me he loved me. And tomorrow always came, empty and silent. Tomorrow constantly robbed me of today, and I was unable to see what was in front of me right now.
Good smooth drink. This is, well, everything I write is special to me, but this is special in a lot of other ways. This is not from the book, but a couple of years ago, I saw the movie Round Midnight. I guess you probably saw it too. And, you know, Dexter Gordon plays a jazz musician in Europe. And although Dexter's a tenor man, the story was really about Bud Powell, piano player. And at the end of the movie, Dexter's standing on the waterfront. His friend is going back to France. And the caption runs across the screen about giving the date, I forget the exact date, but a few weeks after this day, however long it was, he died. And I was locked up with Bud just before he died. And I used to see these people at least once a week, you know, like Billie Holiday and Dexter and Bud and the Diz, the Bird, and Prez. I used to see them all almost every week in New York. And at this point, a couple of years ago, many, many of them were dead. And they were dead from the same problem I have, a problem with booze and a problem with drugs. And when I saw that film, I had been freed from that stuff for 19 years. And they were dead from it. And I just had this wave of gratitude. It had nothing to do with my thought system. I was just so grateful. And this is kind of my song to them. I don't have to tell you what they contributed to the world. You know. This night, the topic was La Vie en Rose. La Vie en Rose. Your song, Edith. But what melody of the broken heart wasn't your song? Chevalier named you the little sparrow, and so you were. Small, petite, easily unnoticed in the world of glamour, fragile yet so indomitable. What demons haunted your life? What angels sang in your heart? Were you constantly forced to choose between the angels and the demons? Did you know the difference? Did you believe you were putting angels in your arms? And perhaps you were, for surely it quieted the demons for a while. For a while. And though the demons always returned, it was worth living with the angels for a moment, looking at life through rose-colored glasses. But even when those glasses were shattered and the demons ripped at your tattered heart, the angels sang from your throat and stirred our hearts, helping us see a glimmer of light where none was thought to be. How did you do that, my Piaf? How did you turn the pain and agony of constant tragedy into the songs that gladdened our hearts? And did you mend your own broken wings over and over so you could fly to yet another nest, only to once again fall so hard against the pavement that gave you birth? Yes, you were a little sparrow, yet when you sang, the nightingale blushed and marveled at your distinct ability to transform your pain with a lightness the nightingale doesn't know, because it does not know the heaviness in your heart. I never saw you, but feel such a kinship. I never saw you, yet we are sisters, brothers, one in the heart. I never saw you, but I know you were so slight, so pale. Yet so like Lady Day, who was black. And like you and Billy sang, she transformed hundreds of years of tragic history into a towering victory of spirit. She too carried on a tradition, one in her blood, and one she learned from Bessie and so many others. As I love your pale fragility, so I love Lady's black strength. But who could think of color when she sang, or you? Because the music went right to the heart and resonated with the love from the soul. The little sparrow, Lady Day, and me. Different arms, different tracks, same path. We took the journey together, and I know what manner of tortured hearts beat under our blue-dotted flesh. There were times when Lester Young would play behind Billy. She'd stand at the edge of the stage, swaying, getting ready for the next tune, and the Prez would swish up behind her and put the bell of his axe up against her bottom and play Lover Man. And Billy would wiggle her cute little thing, smiling, and sort of crooned, kind of deep and throaty, "Oh, Prez." It was always like the phoenix rising from its ashes as the indomitable spirit rose from the tragedy of its existence. "Billy's gone, little sparrow." And to the end, it seemed like the trees that bore a strange fruit were determined to strip her of every vestige of dignity before she could go quietly into the much-needed night. Friends would bring her a little dope, something to sniff so she could thumb her nose at the generic pneumonia that was killing her. A nurse saw the white smudge on Billy's nose, easy enough to see, and blew the whistle. And so the visits were cut off, those allowed in searched, and a police officer guarded the dangerous prisoner as she slipped into the comfort of the sleep where those concerns no longer exist, and she could sing her song in the light. Lady had her day, but it seems like her nights were so despairingly endless, and now both have joined to shroud her with sleep. How many days did you have, little sparrow? A few here and there, but always swallowed by the darkness. It seems the sunshine came only on a man's shoulders, and it seems it was always inappropriate and ill-fated. Then Marcel Cerdan entered your life. He too fought his way up from the streets. Yours were Parisian, his Algerian. His streets became a ring, and then cheering thousands of fans, and his hunger clobbered men into submission. As with you, he fought his way to the very top and into your sparrow's heart. Another inappropriate liaison, but this time it seemed to be blessed. But you had your nurse and guard too, and a routine flight to Paris, and you ended in strewn wreckage and black headlines. And once again, the little sparrow was alone, seemingly abandoned and rejected by the very angels that gave her the song she sang. And in time, the angels defeated the demons, and you too were free of the struggle, and another part of me is gone. Yet I somehow continue, not knowing from time to time if it's the mercy of the angels that keeps me going, or my defiance of the demons. There have been so many songs cut off in mid-verse, so many seemingly lost bridges. I was locked up with Bud Powell shortly before he died, a man I used to see and hear almost weekly at one time, along with so many others like Prez and Bird and countless others who walked our path. Bud was one of the greatest musical geniuses of the 20th century. And when I think of him, the image that comes to mind is not of him at the old Rooster Birdland, but leaning against the wall in the psych ward at Kings County, eating a candy bar and grinning the grin of a man separated from himself. So many times I have seen him hunched over the keyboard, a quart container of beer on the piano, finding chords that no one knew existed and putting them together with imagination and brilliance, creating music second by second. But that's not the image of Bud that comes to mind, but rather Bud hanging over a piano they rolled into the ward, that same grin on his face, hunting, hunting, hunting across the keyboard, unable to find what he had many years before found and had already given to us. So many are gone. I loved them, and still do. And so many of them are gone, have been for many years, and yet I remain here now. And from time to time I think, not why I'm here and they're not, not a case of they were so much more talented than I am far beyond wondering and or comparing. I think about finishing their song by singing mine. I believe not only that I can, but that I must, or what is heaven for?
I believe there is only one song in the universe, and we are the song. You, me, Billy, Piaf, Bud, all singing the same song in our own way. Only one song, so we must keep singing. Oh God, help me. Help me to sing my song so theirs can go on, and their non-existent flesh cast off its scars. Those blue-dotted cries of pain. Oh, my dear, sweet God, I love my friends as I do you, and would sing their songs for them so their spirits can rejoice and cast off the habitual shackles that kept them chained in their cells. I pray that no pain goes unsoothed, no fear unloved, and that I will continue to hear your song sung by your kids, and we will all rejoice in the spirit that continues to see not beauty in ugliness, not joy in pain, but infinite possibilities in each other. The sparrow showed us it could be done, as did Billy, Bud, and millions of others who every day sing your song through endless heartbeats of pain. I thank all of you. All of you. And every time I manage to get one more breath into this body, I will sing a song of thanks to you, my brothers, my sisters, my friends. May your sleep be peaceful, and angels sing sweetly in your ears.
Thanks a lot, man. Just great.
The angels. Hartelijk dank voor jullie aanwezigheid. Tot de volgende keer.
I was an old blues guy. You know, one of those guys that steals wives and daughters and goes off to the next show. Keith Richards. Yeah, okay, he's ugly, but that is to his advantage. Steve McQueen, yeah, he's handsome, but he looks like he's got the temperament of a pit bull on a good day. I wish I could have been one of those guys, but I think I'm going to have to give all that up and just try like hell to be a man instead.
It's fine.
Okay.